This is CICK News. Watsa is not a traditional horror film, but a short film production by House of Copper Films that tells an ancestral story of the River Otter people through the Somaliach language, subtitled in English. The film, made by and for the community, is told through the stories passed down from elders. Filmed in the historic North Pacific Cannery, the short film explores cultural memory, language revitalization, as well as a supernatural legend, while also making waves on the festival circuit from Vancouver to Hollywood. Directed by Dustin McGladrey, produced by Rosie Johnny Mills, and written by Dustin McGladrey and Jeremy Paul, this short film captures viewers immediately with its lush dramatic scenery of the cannery and keeps you guessing until the end, all the while teaching you Somaliach, the language of the Tsimshian people, and my first interviewee, Will Ux Batska Gala, or Jeremy Paul.
Jeremy Paul is English name. Wiluk Spetska Galau is my true Tsimshian name. And I belong to the community of Hartley Bay and the Eagle Clan of House of Tatkwak.
Can you start by telling me who is Watsa or what is Watsa?
Watsa is a transformer. They are a shapeshifter. There's been so many stories about this supernatural being, and Watsa literally translates into river otter in our language.
I'm really excited because what we're talking about today and why we started the conversation there was because that's the title of a horror film. So can you tell me just a little bit about how did you get involved in Watsa the film?
I was talking to a couple of filmmakers, Rosie Johnny Mills and Dustin McGladrey. Rosie's from the Haida and the Cowichan Nation, and Dustin's from the Nisga Nation. They were working for Knowledge Network at the time. They wanted to do like a mini doc through the First Peoples Culture Council on language revitalization. So we talked about that, but that project never got off the ground. But we became fast friends, so it was like, oh, we should do something, right? So we got to talk in, and like Dustin had heard my music, and we got to talking about what the songs were about, and then we got to the song Watsa, and I told them what inspired it, and they were both just, this has to be a film. Like, it has to be. And from there we got, it's like a real modest little budget. We had a skeleton crew and we really pinched some pennies to make it work. All of the people that were working on this film provided massive discounts on their work. Mm-hmm. And all of them are very good at what they do, obviously, but all of them really believed in the project. And we're all so glad that it was able to be done and that they were so generous.
Yeah. Is this the first ever Somaliach language horror film? And then also, can you talk a little bit about the significance of where you filmed it as well, at the cannery?
Yeah, for sure. To my knowledge, it is the first. It's the first of its kind. It's the first like creative non-documentary film that we've ever had that's totally in our language. We filmed at the cannery because one of the stories that I'd heard that inspired the song has to do with that cannery. And my, so that comes from a story from my grandpa, who, when he was a kid, used to stay there with his mother and our family. His older sister, he used to go visit, who was at North Pacific. And my grandpa and his mom were staying at Sunnyside, which is like some, like, few kilometers the other direction, or further along the tidal portion of the mouth of the Skeena. Inverness Passage is where it is.
Okay.
And I guess one day he was walking between the two canneries, and there's a railway line that goes in between them. It's the quickest path to go between the canneries. So he used to walk that all the time back and forth when he would visit Rosie. And he said that one time it was dusk, and he noticed, like, he felt something wrong. So he followed his instinct and turned around and saw that there was a man following him on the railroad tracks. So he got spooked. He didn't know who it was. So he ran, and when he looked back, there was no person anymore. There was a river otter slinking along the railroad tracks. And he got to the house there and burst in the door and told his mother with his face what he'd seen, because he wasn't able to talk. He was just in total shock and horror. And she just told him, like, what her instinct was. And she was like, "Oh, you saw the Whatza, didn't you?" And he was like, "Yeah, she just knew." So that's the part of the film where it gets to the song, and that's where that lyric comes from.
A really neat moment is where your character and then a Japanese man, another character, exchange like a kind of sort of in a stilted conversation where you're sort of like miming what you mean, but within it you learn that the Somaliak word for foot is the same as the Japanese word. So is that how did you learn that, or is there a lot of crossover between the two? Because that's a really, it's a really cool teaching moment actually in this very short film.
Nam sebasu.
Asi o itameta.
Sip ke sin. Ari kula te plai te kwa. Si.
Asi, demo daijoubu. Chawan o wasureta.
For sure. Yeah, and that's in my day-to-day. I definitely am working with the language a lot, and one of my special interests that hasn't been, like, documented before is the relationship between the Japanese language and Somaliak language. And I only know about these things because of the canneries. So yeah, talking to old timers and them being like, "Oh yeah, like they have the same word for foot." And then there's, like, also a landlocked head that is now a trout, but at one point in history was a salmon that has the same sounding name as our word for sockeye, which is maso, and their word for that landlocked salmon is masu. So there's this kind of phenomenon that linguists call cognates. So there is where it just happens to sound similar to another word in the other language that by language family is completely unrelated. But the yeah. My argument is that there's too many cultural parallels. I just learned yesterday that, like, Japanese people have wailers, like wailers that can go to a funeral to cry, to get people going, to get them to release their tears, and they're paid for that service. And Tsimshian have the exact same thing. There's a bunch of those, like, little parallels where I'm like, "Oh, it's not just a coincidence." So, and it's a small snippet of the film, but I just really wanted to just throw that in there. That's, like, my little special interest, like, personal research project.
Yeah, you're like it seems like such a good vehicle too, because you're part of this new generation of artists and storytellers and like language revitalizers that are re-engaging in Somaliak language through your work with the Tsimshian Culture Society. Do you feel this like excitement or this growing interest, or are you seeing like this result where there are more speakers and you're finding yourself more enveloped in the language? And I guess how does the film then just settle into that nicely?
Yeah, for sure. I think Kelly, who also starred in the film, gets to see a lot more of that firsthand because she is a Somaliak teacher at the high school. But I get to hear about all these keeners that are just so pumped to embark on this language journey and to know that there's people of all walks and levels of fluency that can come together for this common goal, and that number is growing is that's really nice. It's really nice to know.
Yeah. Lastly, so tell me about who some of these film festivals are that have showed interest in Watsa.
We're gonna have the film screened at the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival in Portland, Vancouver Horror Fest, which is coming up in October. There's another like horror themed film festival that is in New Brunswick that we're going to be at, and then one in LA. That's like the theater. It's cool that our film is going to be showed in a theater that's a block away from the stars on the sidewalk thing in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. It's pretty damn cool.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for sharing the film with me for me to be able to see it. It was very cool.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. So stoked to that you had me aboard on the show.
Next, I spoke to the director of this short film and major film buff, Dustin McGladrey, about how it was made and the unique challenge of telling a story that lives. A story that simply cannot mean one thing to all who know it, as was the case with Watsa.
My name is Dustin McGladrey. My Niska name is Kind-Hearted Grizzly Bear. I come from the Niska Nation, from Gitlahtamix, Nuayanch. My clan is the Grizzly Bear Clan, or People of the Hawthorn Bush, and I come from the House of Shtain. I am a director, a writer, and I'm also a film editor. I went to UBC and Capilano University for about 5 years of schooling, and now I work in film, television, and all that stuff. Just lots.
Thank you so much for making time to speak with me. The film that we're speaking about today is Watsa, and I wonder if we could actually start just by you telling me what the legend of Watsa means to you.
On a metaphorical and spiritual level, it's reclamation of our stories and our oral histories and translating that onto screen. That's huge to me. With any oral histories in Adauk, people are going to have their own interpretations of what it means. So I don't want to say this is what the movie is. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that would be my answer for what it is. It's just important to get these kinds of stories onto screen. And one of the things that we talked with some of the elders, maybe Jeremy talked about this a little bit, some of the elders were worried that we were going to tell this story in general, invoking that spirit along with many other types of spirits. It can be dangerous work to do, even just telling those stories. But for us to actually depict one on screen and have a human be that supernatural spirit, it could be dangerous. But we explained in a way where it's like we're trying to translate oral histories onto screen. This is the new oral histories that we're doing right now. And that's the way we do our work in film. We treat it like it's a potlatch. I've talked with Gwai Edenshaw about this. Where film is potlatching. The ceremony is done when it's done. All the work that we put into it, it's a lot of work that we have to do. And it's all work that we've done in the past. We're just doing it now. You know what I mean?
What has this looked like in your career of kind of, are you seeing a resurgence or a reclamation or even more interest from maybe the public and non-Nishka, non-Shimsian people that want to know more about language and these stories? Are you seeing that in your work?
The short answer is yes. The people that have heard about this project, they want to see it. People in general, are trying to learn our languages. I'm trying to learn my language as well. I want all of the opportunities that other languages have, I want that for our languages. Like these films that we make, what would my little kid self want to see? You know, they want to see themselves on screen. They want to see their languages on screen, see how cool they are, take ownership of identity. And film and media is one way to do that. So I think that this Indigenous Renaissance that we're in, especially on the West Coast, is starting. And we're going to see more films with our languages on screen. It's so important that happens.
I think that's the interesting thing about film as a way to capture a living language, something that is like, it's because often it's like, what if you have to retake? What if you have ADR? That must be a funny line to straddle for you as a filmmaker.
Yeah, it's very, in a way, it's freeing because I guess I'm Niska, but Jeremy's Tsimshian, right? Mm-hmm. But our languages are so similar. So when I was in the edit for this, when I heard like the elders' different takes, I could still stitch it together because I understand the language. I know what he's saying. So it wasn't that hard in that respect. That's where positionality comes in, right? Indigenous people need to be telling Indigenous stories. We can't have non-Indigenous folk come in and tell our stories. That doesn't make any sense. And this is proof of concept of that. So when I'm on set and listening to the elder give these different takes, yes, I'm stressing out in the moment, but I know it's going to be okay.
It's an impactful but short movie.
Yeah.
But it actually goes through these arcs of, oh, I'm supposed to feel comforted. Now I'm supposed to feel uneasy.
The music even sets the tone right away. Like, okay, this is supposed to be eerie. You're supposed to feel eerie when you have the lighthearted moments, especially when the Japanese starts getting spoken.
Yeah.
That's fascinating to me as a filmmaker, seeing that kind of like cultural fusion. I think we had a lot of fun making this film and looking forward to making more like this. Telling a Dawak is something that I'm really passionate about. I'm excited to continue.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much.
Watsa is not available for audiences just yet, as it needs to complete its festival circuit first. But stay tuned to House of Copper Films production company for updates and when you can watch Watsa with your family and friends. A judicial review is underway over the BC government's decision to allow the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline project to proceed under a decade-old environmental certificate. Petitioners argue the Environmental Assessment Office, or EAO, acted unreasonably when it ruled the project had achieved a, quote, substantial start, despite no permanent infrastructure being built. They say the certificate is outdated, ignoring new data on salmon habitat, air quality, and climate change. The case could set an important precedent for how future industrial projects in BC are assessed.
Hi, my name is Matt Holf. I'm a lawyer at EcoJustice, which is a public interest legal charity that works across Canada.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Could you bring our listeners up to speed on EcoJustice's application, along with community groups, for judicial review against the BC government in regards to the Prince Rupert gas transmission?
This past June, the BC government, the chief executive assessment officer of the Environmental Assessment Office, made a decision that the Prince Rupert gas transmission pipeline had been substantially started. And that means that in this decision maker's opinion, the pipeline had started enough construction that he could decide that the environmental assessment certificate would be extended or permitted to continue for the rest of the pipeline's life. If the decision maker had decided that the pipeline had not been substantially started, the certificate would have expired. And if the project wanted to continue, the proponent would have had to undergo a whole new environmental assessment of the project.
What should these community groups be prepared for?
Some of these community groups have been involved in litigation in the past. And Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition and the Kistox Valley Community Centre Association, two organizations that have been quite involved in the regulatory process for the PRGT pipeline. And they've been involved starting way back in 2013. So they are in themselves experts about the project. With respect to the litigation itself, all the clients, all three have been involved in providing their own evidence, putting that information into an affidavit that's been submitted to the court to support the claims that we're making, support our arguments.
The legal challenge won't pause pipeline construction since no injunction has been requested. If the petitioners win, the court could rule the government's decision was unreasonable and send it back for reconsideration. That could force the project into a new environmental review, but it is not guaranteed.
This pipeline passes through within a couple kilometers of some of these our clients' homes, passes right through their communities. It passes a landowner that we're representing. It goes within, I think it's like 250 meters of her property. And this is like a pipeline that's 4 feet wide and would push gas through all day long for decades. So it's, and then there's a big clearing on either side of the pipeline where trees are cut down so that the company can access the pipeline. So these things are big intrusions on the landscape, and they change how habitats work. And these compressor stations, there could be up to 8 of them along the pipeline. and they operate 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and push out, emit lots of harmful pollutants into the atmosphere that could affect people's health. So it's important.
Thank you to Matt Hulse for taking the time to speak with me. Next on CICK News, we hear from Shannon McPhail, co-executive director of the Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition. Her group is one of several petitioners taking the BC government to court over its decision to let the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline move forward under an expired environmental certificate. At the heart of the case is whether the province ignored its own rules when it declared the project had made a substantive start despite no permanent infrastructure being built. McPhail says the stakes are high for salmon, forests, and the long-term health of northern communities. Let's hear from Shannon now.
So the legal action we're launching is ultimately about holding our provincial decision makers accountable for their decisions. And the environmental assessment certificate for the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline project expired in November of last year. So in the case of this judicial review that we've launched, we're questioning how is it that a project can have 0% permanent infrastructure installed when their own substantive start determination policy and previous court cases that have tested this determine that you do need a significant amount of permanent infrastructure installed. So the decision to grant the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline a substantive start determination didn't just lower the bar, it eliminated the bar completely. So there isn't much point in having a substantive start determination policy and framework if our government decision makers just aren't going to follow that policy.
At what point were you in this process? Were you maybe personally or your organization that you just said, okay, enough?
Well, honestly, it all started about 12 years ago when I sat in meetings with government and with industry, with title holders, with community members, you know, my fellow community members, trying to learn about this industry. And what's interesting is what was promised 10, 12 years ago, the laws that were in place, the commitments that government made, those conditions no longer exist. You can now put pipelines and roads through parks, and that was to help pave the way for LNG. That was Christy Clark. She changed the Park Act in order to allow for pipeline development. The Nishka Memorial Lava Beds, a section of the lava beds were removed so they could put the pipeline through the lava beds. You can't even take a lava rock out of there because it's considered being disrespectful to the ancestors, but they're going to trench a pipeline right through it. There was the LNG Income Tax Act that no longer exists. There was the LNG Prosperity Fund created that we were supposed to make, you know, have like an economic windfall from to support the province financially. All the money that has been put in there has come from the public, not from LNG. There was an LNG job site created to connect, you know, British Columbians to all of these LNG jobs. Not a single job was created or granted or given as a result of that website. Also, I think it's important for people to understand that both our provincial and federal government are now major financiers of this industry. So not only are they investing directly through Export Development Canada, through financial and loan guarantees, they are also purchasing equipment. So the federal government purchased more efficient gas powered turbines for LNG Canada. We've just invested $400 million into Cedar LNG directly.
Shannon points to taxpayer subsidies as another concern. Taxpayer dollars and BC Hydro ratepayer money are increasingly being steered toward powering massive industrial projects, especially LNG and mining, rather than primarily serving households and small businesses. Documents show these industries want huge amounts of electricity, and in some cases rivaling the output of the newly built Site C Dam. But in order to meet that demand, BC Hydro will need costly new generation and transmission infrastructure. Critics warned that this could push hydro bills higher for everyday British Columbians and effectively subsidize international corporations. Supporters like Energy Minister Adrian Dix argue that electrifying heavy industry is an economic opportunity and will create cleaner energy jobs.
So we're using clean energy to support dirty energy, and we're calling the dirty energy the cleanest dirty energy in the world. And it's a bit laughable.
How is this petition going to be a part of making or make a dent in this systemic change that you want to see?
Well, what I ultimately hope to achieve with this judicial review is that the judge will agree and say, wow, this, you know, there has never been a lower bar for granting a substantive start determination than this one right here. And I agree with the petitioners and state or rule that the substantive start should not have been granted. If that's the case, then the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Project will have to reapply for a new environmental assessment, which we suggested they do anyway, because their environmental assessment is over 10 years old. We suggested that the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Project should have to go through an updated environmental assessment, not just because 10 years had passed, but because so much has changed since they were granted their environmental assessment certificate. It's called the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline Project, but it doesn't even go to Prince Rupert anymore, because it was originally slated to go to the Pacific Northwest LNG terminal that was proposed for Liliu Island in the estuary of the Skeena River. That project was scrapped in 2017. The pipeline, without being connected to a terminal that had an environmental assessment certificate or a final investment decision, was still granted a construction start. And when they started constructions 3 months before the environmental assessment certificate had expired, it was a pipeline to nowhere. Like, it didn't have an approved terminal to go to. There have been so many amendments to the environmental assessment certificate that we suggested that a new environmental assessment process was needed, because what was approved back in 2014 versus the pipeline project that exists now, they don't even compare. We are not an organization historically who is taken to the courts. What usually happens is we create community meetings and we invite decision makers to come sit with community, hear people's concerns. And historically, government has listened when there has been solid reasoning, good evidence provided, and solutions suggested. We are no longer dealing with that kind of government.
The Environmental Assessment Office of BC declined to comment on my questions about their criteria or internal guidance process to determine how a substantial start was defined for the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Project, or how they would respond if the court decision found their claim unreasonable, and how they would commit to an updated environmental assessment. They said that they do not provide comments on any matter which is before the court. The next couple of months will be time for the Kispiox Valley Community Centre Association, Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition, and local resident Kathy Larson, as well as lawyers from EcoJustice, to prepare for their days in court in front of the BC government to challenge their claim that the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Project earned the certificate of a substantial start 10 years after the project's initial environmental assessment. As well, Gitsan Hereditary Chief from the Frog Clan, Charlie Wright, as a representative of his WILP, is asking the court to overturn the province's decision on this project for the same reason, stating that a substantial start was a bogus claim, also stating that the BC government, quote, clearly falls short on free, prior, and informed consent, and continues to set the stage for inevitable conflict in the region, and in particular, on our territory and involving Gitsan laws, end quote. This was information pulled from a media release from the Frog Clan House of the Gitsan, sent to CICK News yesterday, September 29th. CICK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.